You're listening to Everything is Workable, a podcast that examines how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of Dharma talks, Dharma books, self-help books, and the wisdom of others. I started this podcast as a way of showing my gratitude for these teachings and to expand my own understanding. Thank you so much for tuning in. So when I was 15, I used to spout "labels are for food" as a sort of mantra. I carried a lot of teenage angst and irritation around with me about being labeled when I was in junior high, and then as I got older actually, despite the fact that I chose an abundance of labels for myself, like bisexual, freak, weirdo, etc. and so on. The point was that I didn't like how other people labeled me, which makes sense. I was really irked by the assumptions people made, along with all of the labels that they attached to those assumptions. And then I was really vocal about the importance of letting people define themselves. Like, if you want to get to know someone, then talk to them, ask them questions, listen to their answers, and appreciate that a label that someone uses at one point might not work for them later, and so on. This was all largely, though, about other people's choices of labels and how other people's labels came across to me as really limiting, because I really did care a lot about what other people think. I mean, I still care about what other people think, but I don't let it dictate my choices anymore so much. Moving on. I'm older, hopefully a bit wiser, knowing that getting older does not by default lead to greater wisdom. And I've recently begun taking this label thing to a whole new level. Because identity goes a lot deeper than social grouping based on preferences or how we look. Identity is also quite emotional, and our emotional states can become labels that define us. For example, someone might say that they're a jealous person, or someone might say that they aren't a jealous person. So then we get this idea, and they themselves hold an idea of who they are based on that assessment of an emotional expression. I'm sure that you've already got an image in your head when I say that. Someone says, "I'm not jealous." There's an assumption that what they're really saying is that they're not possessive or controlling. Or someone says that they are jealous, we would think like maybe they are really controlling, or maybe they seek validation from having exclusive attention from one person in particular. I know I don't really have to give these descriptions of what a jealous person is, just saying a jealous person makes anyone think of an abundance of different behaviors that we would associate with that particular emotive state. So I'm going to use a personal example. For years, I said that I'm not really an angry person, which is to say that I don't often lash out or express anger. I don't really feel grumpy most of the time, for example, and I find that I'm not very easily irritated. So what? You might be thinking, right? This is normal. Everyone does this. We all label ourselves in these ways, and we all label other people in these ways. Well, here's the thing about this line of thinking. It's limiting. It's not accurate. And it can be really harmful. To be a human being is to experience a full range of emotions. We're all capable of every human emotion. Some maybe more than others, but no emotion is exclusively definitive of a single person, as in a happy person or an angry person. Rather, to be a person, to be a human being, is to be emotive. And emotive states, emotional states, are temporary. Any single one of us can and will experience anger, joy, jealousy, happiness, fear, excitement, anxiety, depression, and so on and so forth. If we claim to not be an angry person, as I did for so long, or have for so long, seriously, like up until a few years ago, then we also risk not looking at our anger, ever. And the same goes with how we positively define ourselves. Pema Chodron talks often about how she thought of herself as this really sweet and loving person, And as a result, she didn't really look at her very human tendencies to get irritated or annoyed or upset with people for years. By defining an emotion as something we are or are not, we exclude and disregard entire chunks of our experience. We consider the moments when anger arises, for example, if we decided we're not an angry person, as an anomaly. We also tend to disassociate ourselves from those who we would define as what we claim not to be. It's a basic thing about labeling. Once we put someone in a box over there, if it's a box we don't identify with or don't think we can understand, then we don't want to go in that box. So angry people are over there, and they're not like me. And then because, you know, they're angry and angry is seen as negative, then angry people can also easily be labeled as bad people. Because anger is bad, everyone knows that. And because I'm not an angry person, I'm a good person. And therefore somehow I'm better than that person over there who's an angry person. And then I just reinforce the need to not look at any anger that I experience. Because of course, if I choose to notice that anger, then I've established myself as an angry person, and therefore as a bad person. When we've done that sort of compartmentalizing of emotional states as an actual human being, then we think to acknowledge something that is a natural emotion that arises in us would be to acknowledge some element of badness in ourselves. My practice is dominated with cultivating self-awareness. One of my mantras is, we can't work with that which we do not see. So I regularly examine my state of mind. I want to get to know all the different states of mind that I have, and then everything that comes along with that as well. And especially the messy or unpleasant stuff that I don't like looking at. By doing this, I'm actively cultivating compassion for myself, and in doing so, recognizing shared humanity, and therefore, cultivating compassion for others. Compassion for the self is compassion for others, because we're all humans. The process has and continues to emphasize how dualistic thinking is not reflective of how things actually are. There's no such thing as good people and bad people. People are people, and our states of mind, our emotional landscapes, our actions, they're all temporary. They do not define us, although they are intrinsically part of us. Any and every person is capable of doing harmful things. Any and every person is capable of immense kindness. By coming to see this in ourselves, to see how, as a person, as a human being, we experience jealousy or anger or fear, we begin to recognize it in other people. And then, other people stop being other people, and they're just, well, people. Just like we're a person. Not a jealous person, but a person who has or is currently experiencing a particular emotion. Of course, most of us have spent huge chunks of our lives, probably most of our lives, thinking of ourselves as particular types of people. Breaking this habit, recognizing the limitations of it, is no easy task. In fact, I'd say it's a lifelong task, a multiple lifetime task, if future lives are something that makes sense to you, and they do for me, so I'm going to be doing this for many lifetimes to come, and I suspect I already have been. So how do we go about cultivating a mindset that recognizes the temporary state of everything, and that no one, including ourselves, is or ever was just one way? To cover off the obvious, there's meditation, of course. Meditation is, as Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche taught, a process of making friends with ourselves. To make friends with ourselves is to learn how to show up for ourselves no matter what, to see all of our states of mind, aggressive, fearful, depressed, and so on. And then not bad to these things, but get to know them. Get to know how they manifest in our bodies, what propensities we carry that trigger them, and how we can learn to change our responses to them. Meditation sets us up on a habitual path of noticing. So when we aren't meditating, we don't always go unconscious in our behavior. we might actually start to pause and give thought to how we are limiting ourselves, because our thinking just switched from I'm experiencing anxiety to I am anxious, or I'm feeling a lot of anger to they made me angry. Of course, doing it spontaneously in the moment won't happen overnight, which is why contemplation is another essential tool. It sort of carries forward the momentum that you get from doing a regular meditation practice. Contemplation is basically doing thought experiments. So you don't actually have to be experiencing the emotion to contemplate it, and you don't have to be formally sitting as you would in meditation. In fact, it's really beneficial to contemplate something when it's not actually up for us, like a rehearsal for when it is. I mean, you can use what I said a moment ago, where you can examine how rewording a thought like, I'm anxious, to something like, I'm feeling a lot of anxiety at the moment, changes your experience of anxiety. And these are the kinds of things you can contemplate anytime. It's something you can do to pass the time while you're waiting in a queue or if you're stuck in traffic or something like that. But if you want to do it as like a formal contemplation, I recommend sitting in a meditation position or something else that's relaxed but not like floppy. And then really give some time to the analysis of it. Like switch it up between different emotions that you identify strongly with and then also emotions that you don't really identify strongly with. And just play around with statements and how your body feels after each one. Like tell yourself, I'm angry, and see what that brings up, how it feels, where you feel it. Does it have a texture? Does it have a color? How does it make you envision yourself in your head? And then tell yourself, I'm feeling anger at the moment, and see how that feels and where you feel that in your body and if that changes how you're envisioning yourself. And another way that I work with this, specifically when I'm really rejecting an emotional state that I see as negative, is to human myself. Negative emotions come up and I'm labeling myself as messed up or neurotic, and instead I label those thoughts as thoughts and just let them pass by, and then instead I actually consciously put in the label human. And I recruit others to human me as well. My wife, for example, has my permission to point out to me when I'm being hard on myself for being human. I might be upset or stressed about something and talking to her, and then I apologize for it. I apologize, like say, oh, I'm really sorry I'm being so messy, something like that. And she'll give me this look, furrowed brow, sort of puzzled, and she'll just say, I'm sorry, are you human? And while I was still seeing my psychologist, she did something that was quite similar by pointing out that if I was getting frustrated, oh, like, you're getting frustrated at yourself for not being enlightened yet? You're a human being. Basically, the practice of humaning ourselves is a reminder. Humans feel emotions. Humans get upset. Humans aren't always great at handling intense emotions. To share a pithy statement that a friend of mine posted to Facebook recently, human is a small word that means a lot. So this week, I'm inviting you to human yourself. I'm inviting you to contemplate and take a look at your emotional states and how you might be limiting yourself with emotional labels by identifying with the emotions rather than seeing them as temporary. Look at how you let them define you, and also how you might use them to avoid looking at an aspect of your emotional landscape that you're uncomfortable with. This is all about baby steps, of course. If you've never done this sort of practice, give yourself some time. Patience is really important. There's no such thing as a quick fix, but I promise this is definitely something that will make your life a whole lot more workable. Thank you so much for listening to Everything is Workable. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share with your friends, or post it to social media. You can also consider becoming a patron, which has really cool perks like getting art prints or a signed book in the post. Just click the green Become a Patron button on the Everything is Workable Podbean page. Thank you as well to the very talented Dexter Britton for sharing his music with the world so that I could use it for this podcast. You can find more of his stuff on www.dexterbritton.com. fawnawolfcreations.co.uk, and you can find more of my stuff at fawnawolfcreations.com.